Title of my sermon today is Violent Seasons. Now those are not my words. Those are the words of the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul wrote to Timothy in the book of 2 Timothy. This was a book directed to Timothy. And in chapter 3, as Paul is in prison, he has this understanding of prophetic events that are going to take place. And he says this to Timothy, but realize this. I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, chapter 3 and verse 1. But realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. Difficult times. In the last days, difficult times will come. The word times is a word that should be, it can very easily be, seasons. Difficult seasons. It's not meaning a sustained time, but rather seasonal times. You know, we have the fall season, we have spring season. Well, you could run into a difficult season, a very violent season. In the last days. Now, when are the last days? Are the last days now? Are we? How many of you believe we are in the last days? Let me see your hands. Okay. Some of you don't believe we're in the last days. Well, I do. I believe we're in the last days. I believe we've been in the last days a long time. How long have we been in the last days? Well, the book of Hebrews says in chapter 1, verse 2, in these last days, God has spoken to us in a son. Now, prior to that, God spoke to us by prophets in many ways, in various ways. He spoke to us in the prophets or through the prophets. But in these last days, he's spoken to us in a son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom he made the worlds. Now, the New Testament talks plainly about from the time of Jesus Christ's coming, that began the last days, when Christ first came on the scene. You see it in the book of James, James 5 and verse 3. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasures. So James is talking, it's in the last days right now. Peter writes in chapter 1, verse 5, who are protected by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. Is salvation revealed to us? Of course it is. It's revealed in the last time. 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, children, it is the last hour. Just as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have appeared. From this we know that it is the last hour. So it's the last time, it's the last days, and in the last days, difficult seasons. Seasons, they're going to be difficult. Now actually, the Greek word here for difficult, and King James uses the word perilous times, means difficult, stressful, hard to deal with, violent, dangerous. The only other place where this Greek word is used in the New Testament that is translated difficult or perilous in the King James is in the book of Matthew chapter 8 and verse 28. And in the book of Matthew, if you remember, Jesus was walking through. He came through this country of the Gadarenes, and he saw two men who were demonic. They were demon-possessed. They met him as they were coming out of the tombs. They were walking around these tomb areas, and Jesus is walking down, and the Bible says, and I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, they were so extremely violent that no one could pass by them. Okay, they were so extremely violent that no one could pass by them. Violent is the word. Same word as we have translated perilous, translated difficult. So in the last days, from the time of Christ. And Paul is warning Timothy, you're going to run into these various seasons. There are going to be seasons, periods of time when they will be very violent and very dangerous and very difficult. Difficult for the ministers of God, difficult for you, Timothy, as an evangelist. And if by implication, then difficult for all Christians, because it's preserved in the New Testament for you and me. Now, why does he say this? Why? So beginning in verse 2. Here's the reason these seasons are going to be difficult. It's not because the wind is going to blow. It's not because lightning's going to strike. It's because of men. Who's the cause of this violence and this difficulty and this stress? For men, meaning humans, people. It's a generic term for all people. For people will be. Now the next, after verse 2, the Apostle Paul lists 19 different negative characteristics about people. 19 of them. So, the first one, people will be what? Lovers of self. Lovers of self. Now, do you know that the Greek word phileo, philia, means to love, to be friends of something, to care for it, to want it, to be love it, okay? It's another word for love, phileo. And then there's agape, okay, agapao. But this is, there's a Greek word, phileo, means I love it. And this word is a combination of phileo and the word autos. We get the word auto. You know, you have an automobile. It's a self-propelled, self-moving. Auto, we get that from the Greek word autos. So we have phileo, meaning self-lovers, lovers of self. And it means it in a selfish way. And, you know, even in our generation now, we have this selfishness that has come on to people. You know, I deserve it. You ever notice these advertisements? You should have this because you deserve it. You know, you deserve to have the best. You deserve to have this. You deserve it. Well, why do they deserve it? Why do you deserve it? Did you work for it? We have a generation now that's come up. We get all these kids get awards just for showing up. Oh, you're part of the team. You know, you're the worst batter. You're the worst hitter. You haven't practiced at all, but you get a reward. Here's your little trophy, because we don't want anybody to go without a trophy. So we have to give everybody a trophy, no matter how bad they are. And therefore, the people grow up with the idea, I deserve it. I deserve everything. And so now, you've heard of these flash crowds now, haven't you? Flash crowd. Have you seen the flash crowds? A whole bunch of people all together, and they just burst into a store and run up and grab stuff. Flash crowds. I mean, and just jump in and just, you know, there may be 20 or 30 of them, and they burst in and they start helping themselves so fast that the store owners and people can't do anything about it, and everybody's grabbing everything, and this guy's grabbing, that guy's grabbing. You know, you might stop one person grabbing. How are you going to stop 30 or 40 people grabbing? Grabbing things, taking it away, and just, it's like an assault on the store, or assault on the person. It's a new phenomenon. They're calling it flash crowds. It's been around. It's a lot of it back in Philadelphia, a lot of it in the other eastern cities, but it's coming around here. And now the Los Angeles Police Department has just put out a warning that if you're wearing any kind of gold jewelry, you could be assaulted, stuck up, hit, knifed, because, of course, gold is now what? It's got over $1,800 an ounce. So they figure if they can hit you for 1 ounce of gold jewelry, they can have $1,800. And so it's grabbing that, tearing it off you, holding you up, pushing you aside, mugging you for that. Lovers of themselves. Me first. It's the me first generation. It's I think great about me. I think me, I'm first of me and last about you. That's the idea. Lovers of self, philautos. They love themselves. And so this is the very first thing is, and you'll see the word lovers in this, by the way. It's interesting. There are several lovers here. Okay, lovers of something. Lovers of something. And the next one is the lovers of money. Literally, the Greek word means lovers of silver, but it's translated lovers of money because silver was an exchange of money in Roman times. Lovers of money. Well, hey, you know what? If I love myself and I'm selfish and I need for me, what's the next thing I want? I want money because money's going to get me all the things I want for me, isn't it? Lovers of money. Because money will bring me the things I desire, and I will not stop myself from anything that I desire. Lovers of money. They covet it. They want it. And sometimes it's called covetous. I think the King James just translated it covetous. But literally, it means it's lovers of silver. It's the word phil and agouros, meaning silver. You love silver. And I want it. I want that money. I want that possession. Loving it. So here we are. Lovers of self. Lovers of money. And the next thing, would it surprise you that this is the next one? Boastful. Boastful. Means a braggart. They brag about themselves. They brag about what they have. They brag about their accomplishments. They brag. That's what they mean. Boastful. Filled with boasting. You know, we have that in our society today? Of course we do. People love themselves, love their money, I mean, and covet money, want it very badly, and then boastful and bragging. The word boastful means, of course, to brag. The next one is arrogant. Arrogant. Arrogant is a state of being haughty, proud. You know, in the book of James, in chapter 4 and verse 6, it says, God is opposed to the proud. It's the same Greek word. Opposed to the arrogant, the person who's proud. He's lifted up. Arrogant means you're proud, you're lifted up, and also you look down on others. I deserve it. That's the arrogance. I deserve it. It's mine. I should have it. Why should you have it? It should be mine. Even though you earned it, even though you have it, why should you have it and I shouldn't have it? I should have it. Next is revilers. Notice that. Revilers. Slanderers. Or, in King James, I believe, says blasphemous. The Greek word is blasphemos. Blasphemos. And when it's used of people, it means a slanderer, defamation. When it's used about God, it means... We usually use the word blasphemy. It means, in other words, you're saying bad things, evil things about God. Defaming, denigrating, demeaning. Demeaning words, that's what it means. He's no good, he's a lousy creep, he's a this, he's a that, he's a that. And that those are demeaning words from the Greek word revilers. Revilers, defaming people, just saying ugly things about people. And or about God. The next one, very interesting phrase, disobedient to parents. And you'll see that same phrase in the book of Romans, chapter 1, verse 30, where Romans 1, verse 30 talks about Paul listening to this list of words that are very negative, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents. The word disobedient to parents means you're impersuadable. You are not compliant. There's a very highfalutin word called contumacious. Contumacious. I will not be persuaded. I will not. You cannot change my mind. It will not change my mind. My mind is made up and I'm not going to change it. And I am not willing to listen to you. I'm going to do this. And I'm not going to listen to you. Tell me anything. That's the phrase that is translated disobedient to parents. I am not persuadable. I am not compliant. Hey, would you do that? Hey, why don't you think about this before you do this? No, I'm going to do it. I'm not even going to consider your advice. You know, Of all the scriptures, you know, remember you go through the book of Proverbs, my son, give ear to your father's wisdom, give ear to your father's advice. You know, pay attention, listen to the wisdom of your mother. On and on and on, the Proverbs go about being persuadable, listening to another side, listening to other advice before you go off and do something. That's the whole key here of child, you know, of talking about children, listening to other people. But these people will not. They're totally disobedient. They won't listen to their parents, not for one second. Will not accept advice in any way, shape, or form. Disobedient to parents. Not compliant, disobedient, not persuadable. The next one is they're ungrateful. Now think about this. If I love myself, and I feel like I deserve everything because I love myself, right? And I'm covetous of money. I want that. It's all mine, should be mine, and I should have it. Well, why would I be grateful? Why would I be grateful if I deserve everything? What's to thank? What's to be thankful for, right? Who am I going to thank if I deserve it? I deserve it. Why should I thank you? I had it coming. I should have it. That's the idea here. And so notice the next one is ungrateful. The Greek word, the word charis is the word for grace. When you have the word charistos or the word eucharistos, it means a good grace, good grace. And what they used to call the when you take the Lord's Supper, it was called the Eucharist, meaning the place that where you give thanks to God for these symbols that represent Jesus Christ. You're receiving something, so you are very thankful, very grateful to God. Well, this is the word that says, ah, charistos, not grateful. The word ah, a, when you put the word a in front of a Greek word, it nullifies it. It means not. The word a is not grateful. So we say the word moral, and if you could be amoral, you're not moral at all. Okay, amoral. And so the word acharistos means not grateful, not thankful. You're not thanking anybody because I deserve everything. Why should I be grateful? Why should I thank? I have no appreciation, no thanks. I don't want to be obligated to anybody. I don't thank anybody. Now think about running. Now here's Paul talking to Timothy. You've got to run into difficult seasons. They're going to be violent. They're going to be dangerous. They're going to be stressful. Why? Because men are going to be a certain way. People are going to be a certain way. And when you run into generations and seasons where people are a certain way, you're going to have troubles. So he's talking to him. Disobedient to parents, ungrateful. And the next word is unholy. The word here, unholy, as defined by the Art and Gingrich and in the uses of the Greek language in that time, meant being in opposition to God and to what is sacred. I'm in opposition to it. Unholy. The view that certain actions make holy beings or places off limits and invites this connotation of moral turpitude, wicked person. In other words, a revolt against God. A revolt against God. Unholy. No, I'm in opposition. Whatever God says is holy, I'm opposed to it. So in 1 Timothy 1, verse 3, we see this same word. Realizing the fact that the law is not made for a righteous person, but for those who are lawless and rebellious, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy. See, God's law is made for the unholy. It's made for profane people. It's made for those who kill their fathers and mothers and for murderers of others, you know. Let me read that in the Common English Bible, the new translation that just came out. We understand this. The law isn't established for a righteous person, but for the people who live without laws and without obeying any authority. They are the ungodly and sinners. They are people who are not spiritual, and nothing is sacred to them. They kill their fathers and mothers and murder others. So the law is for those people. You know, you don't have the law for you if you're doing what's right. Why do you have to tell you what to do? All right, so we have unholy. Now coming down to verse 3. We can stop in verse 3 now. We start at verse 3. Unloving. Unloving. Now the King James says without natural affection. Okay, but the word is unloving, meaning lacking in good feelings for others, thereby jeopardizing the maintenance of relationships. Hard-hearted. The word can mean hard-hearted or unfeeling with regard to others. I don't care. I don't care what happened to them. I don't care about other people. I have no affection. I have no affection. I'm unloving. I don't love people. I don't love what happens to them. I don't care about them. That's that word. Well, why should you, you know? Because you're a lover of yourself, you see? You're unloving to everybody else because you love yourself only. And you're selfish and you want money. You're just to love money. In Romans 1, verse 31, Paul writes, the same word is used here, they are without understanding, disloyal, without affection, he writes in the Common English Bible, and without mercy. So the next word is irreconcilable. It's also translated truce breakers. This is a Greek word that is used of a person who is unwilling to negotiate a solution to a problem involving a second party. Okay. You and I have a problem. We have a disagreement. And this person is unwilling to negotiate a problem that concerns the second party. In other words, they're irreconcilable. They will not reconcile anything. Irreconcilable. Truce breakers is what the King James uses. You know, they're just irreconcilable. They don't want to negotiate any solution that would be fair to you and fair to them. They don't want to do that. The translation of the New American Standard says malicious gossips. King James says slanderers. Slanderers. Now, when you're called a slanderer in the Bible, that is really a negative word, because the Greek word is diabolos. Be like calling you a devil. You're a devil. A diabolos, or a demon. You're a demon. But the word literally means a slanderer, a person who slanders others. Because what does the devil do? What is the devil's main thing? Accusing the brethren. He's no good, he's rotten, she's no good, she's bad, she hasn't done this, she's bad, she hasn't done that. And you know, and that's what the devil does. He loves it. So when you see people who slander, say bad things about everybody else, that's this. Boy, and when you get into the world of politics, it's filled with that, isn't it? Both parties filled with it. You just slander. It's always constantly. People fall for it, though. They like slandering. They're malicious gossips or slanderers. That means they engage in slander. They're slanderous as people, and one who engages in slander. That's what it means. Diabolos, like the devil, doing the devil's work, really, in a sense. Because you slander, run down, belittle, berate other people. The next trait. Without self-control. Now, self-control for the Greek world was considered a very highly prized trait, attribute. To be controlling of yourself. Now, a lot of people want control. What they want is control of others. They want control of their kids. They want control of this one. They want control of that one. They want control of other people's lives. They want every kind of control except control of themselves. But the Greeks said, if you can control yourself, well, doesn't the Bible in the Old Testament say that? A man who can control his spirit is greater than a person that can conquer a city single-handed. If you can control you, you can control your appetite, you can control your ways, you control your actions, you can control your words, you can control you. They are without self-control. See, self-control is a part of the fruit of the Spirit. You remember in Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 and so on? You know, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, and the last one, I believe, was self-control. That's the part of the fruit of the Spirit, self-control. But these people have no self-control. They have no... Well, why should they? They're entitled, right? Why should they have self-control? I love myself. Whatever myself wants, I give it. In the psychoanalytic world, you know, Freud postured that we have several things. We have the unconscious or the id. He says, well, the id is a drive for pleasure. He has the pleasure principle. The id wants to avoid pain and move toward pleasure. It just wants whatever pleasure it has, and little babies, they don't care. You know, they don't care whose property it is. They want it. If it looks good, and they want to eat it, they don't know whether it's bad for them or not. They just want it. They're driven by this, what he called the id, this cauldron of desires. Then the parents come and say, no, you can't have that. That's not yours. That's not you. You have to give that to Jimmy or Joey or Lloyd or whoever it is. That's not yours. You must give it to someone. You have to share. It's not yours. You cannot take that. And so the parents establish into the child what is called a super ego, because the child now decides to have an ego. The ego starts to want things, but the ego can direct itself with the urgings of the id. But the superego says, no, that's wrong. Even though I want it, I would like to have that, I'd like to take that, it's not mine, I must not have it. I would like to do this, have that. I would like to have the ride in that car, but it's not my car, I must not have it. So the superego puts a brake on the desire. See, there's just constant desire. There's a drive for pleasures. Whatever makes me pleasure, whatever I find pleasure in, I want to do it. Superego says, no, you don't want to do that. But these people don't have that. See, they are without self-control. Whatever they want to do, they do it. But now the next word is, without self-control, then the next word is brutal. The Greek word means also savage. It means they're not tame. Savage. They have no cultural things. They're not, you have, you probably have a house, you've seen house cats if you don't have a house cat. A house cat is tame. House dog is usually tame, but coyotes and wolves are not tame. You don't go up to a coyote. And I saw this thing years ago. This guy saw this, he thought it was a dog. And he stopped the car, and he was going to pick up this dog because he was so caring about animals and all that. And he tried to pick up this dog was biting him and scratching him and biting him. He's trying to fight, trying to help this dog, but the dog was hit by a car. But it turned out to be a coyote. They're just not tame. And the people here are not tame. And then it says, haters of good. They abhor goodness. They are opposed to what is good. And it pertains to a lack of good interest in the public good. They hate good. They hate it if it's good for the public. They hate it they have no interest in what is good for people. In other words, generally we would say they have no social concerns. They are not interested in what is good for the vast majority of people. They are not. Could care less. Why? Well, do you expect a person who is loving themselves and covetous of money to have any kind of concern for what's good for others? Of course not. They abhor goodness. They hate good. The next word is, we come to verse 4, treacherous. The New American Standard Version translates to treacherous. Traitors. The word is betrayer, the same word. They have no loyalty. The same word, this same Greek word in verse 4, translated treacherous in the New American Standard Version, or traitors, I think, in the King James, is the word that is used of Judas Iscariot in Luke chapter 6 and verse 9. Judas Iscariot, the son of James, he's listing the apostles here, or the disciples, to Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Same Greek word. He was a traitor. The next word, and you would not understand this if you're reading the King James, because you wouldn't understand what heady means. A lot of people say heady. Oh, he's heady. Well, that must mean he's very smart, because, you know, he's heady. He's up in his brain. He's heady. But that's not what the King James, that's not what it means. It means reckless. He dives headlong into things. Reckless, impetuous, rash, impulsive, thoughtless about actions. So the Greek word is, in the modern translations, it makes it plainer, reckless. So they're treacherous or traitors and reckless, rash. You'll see this in the book of Acts chapter 19. If you remember when the Apostle Paul went to Ephesus, the city of Ephesus, and he was there, and they were talking about that there are no gods that are made up of statues. Cannot be a real God, and so on. But they're just preaching the gospel that Jesus Christ is the Savior, and so on. And the people of the town thought that they had somehow besmirched Diana, the great goddess, and they began to shout, you know, these people should be stoned and put in prison, and so on. And so one of the town men comes out, and he says to them in the book of Acts, therefore, you know, in other words, he has told them, look, fellas, they haven't said anything against the great, you know, our goddess. They haven't said anything against her. They haven't broken any laws. They have a perfect right to do what they're doing. Then since these facts are undeniable, I'm reading from the Common English Bible now, in Acts 19, verse 36, since these facts are undeniable, you must be calm. You must calm down. Don't be reckless. Don't have this mob violence. Don't start getting reckless, impulsive, and you start rushing to do something that is not correct. Get control of yourself. Calm down. The next one is, King James uses the word high-minded. Now again, don't think high-minded means that you're very smart, you're intelligent, you're really high, but that's not what it means at all. It's puffed up, it means. It means conceited. It means to be puffed up, conceited, to be, and it can also mean to be almost foolishly puffed up. In other words, I'm so conceited in my own thoughts that I become stupid, foolish, or in some cases, mentally ill. Now, the Apostle Paul, in the book of Timothy, 1 Timothy, uses this word twice. He uses it in 1 Timothy 3 in verse 6. He says, talking about those who are ordained, you don't want to ordain a new convert, he says, or he might become conceited, puffed up, you know. He might become puffed up, conceited, and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Okay? So that's one. The second place it's used is in chapter 6 of 1 Timothy. Chapter 6 of 1 Timothy and in verse 4. And I'm going to read this from the MacDonald Idiomatic Translation. He's talking about people who are heretics, or people who just won't listen, who just keep going on with, they're involved in words and machinations and so on. So listen to what it says. He is absurdly proud. That's the word. Understanding nothing. He has a sick preoccupation with speculations and logomachies, that is word things. From such as these derive strife, quarrels, insults, wicked suspicions. So the Apostle Paul is saying, you know, you can get so absurdly proud in your, his word is conceited, so conceited that it leads you to become almost deranged in your thinking. You move over, deranged in your thinking, because you're not able to accept any other view other than yours. That's the point here. Conceited, puffed up, becoming foolish in your ways, and almost mentally ill, becoming blinded to any other side. Now the next word in chapter 3 of 2 Timothy, and now dropping down to verse 4, we had treacherous, reckless, conceited. Now listen to this. Here's the other lovers. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. In the Greek, you would say pleasure lovers, not God lovers. Pleasure lovers, not God lovers. That is to have a special, the pleasure lover means to have a special interest in pleasure. Loving pleasure, pleasure. Just the Greek word is philhedonos. Philhedonos. We get the word hedonism. When you have too much pleasure, there's a philosophy of hedonism, which means the life is about only one thing, and that is gaining as much pleasure from it as possible. Lovers of pleasure, but not lovers of God. Well, no, because you're a lover of yourself, you're a lover of money, now you're a lover of pleasure, but you're not, the one thing you're not is a lover of God. You don't love God. And the Bible has warnings about people who love pleasure, doesn't it? Those who love pleasure, Proverbs 21, verse 17 says, those who love pleasure end up poor. Lovers of wine and oil won't be rich. In 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 5, we have here, they maintain, I'm going to read this from the New English Translation, they maintain the outward, we're going to go to verse 5 in just a second. Okay, they're lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Now we're going to go to verse 5. Holding a form of godliness. They are so self-absorbed, they love themselves, they covet money, they hate what's good, They love pleasure, but they don't love God. They love pleasures, but not God. But notice verse 5, holding a form of godliness. Holding a form of godliness. But denying, what does it say? They have denied its power. So these same people, In these difficult seasons that rise periodically, you have these people, and this becomes number 19, they hold the form of godliness, and they deny its power. Let me read that in the New English Translation. They will maintain the outward appearance of religion, but will have repudiated its power. So avoid people like these. Now, what does that mean, an outward appearance? Well, Paul contrasts several times in his writings power, which shows he regards this as a form that is outward rather than inward. It's not, doesn't have real power. The Holy Spirit is a power that comes inside, and he's showing this is not power on the inside. It's an outward form. It's an outward profession. Take a look at 1 Corinthians. You'll see how the Apostle Paul uses this statement. 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 19 from the Common English Bible goes like this. But if the Lord is willing, I'll come to you soon. Then I won't focus on what these arrogant people say, but I'll find out what power they possess. God's kingdom is not about words, but about power. That's the Apostle Paul's writing. And in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 5, for our gospel did not come to you in word only, but also in power, in the Holy Spirit, and with much assurance, So when you deny the power thereof, see, you're denying the power of God. You have a form of godliness. Can you imagine the insult that these people, heady, high-minded, reckless, unloving, irreconcilable, disobedient to parents, malicious gossips. These people, what do they set up? You think they can set up a religion that can change people from the inside? Of course not. Just come and conform to the form of religion. We have a form of religion. We don't care what you are on the inside. Just kind of come and go through our rituals. Come and genuflect or do whatever else you do. You know, just make sure you do this or that or the other thing that looks good from the outside. Because we don't care what you are on the inside. A form of religion that denies the power of God's Holy Spirit to change your life, to make you into what God is wanting to make you into. A workmanship that is God's. Workmanship that God's working on. And you are then directed to do and be and act and walk in good works. So the Apostle Paul said, "For our gospel did not come to you in word only, but also in power, in the Holy Spirit, and with much assurance. And you know what kind of men we were among you for your benefit." This is shocking and amazing that these people, with all their evils, try to act religious. They have a form, an external form of godliness, but not internal. They have denied the power. Now, what does Timothy say? What is Paul's advice to Timothy? Avoid people such as these. Avoid them, because they're going to now try to, because they're irreconcilable. You can't talk to them. You can't. They will not accept any words. And they're going to try to barter with you, but they're going to try to take their position and shove it if on top of you. They're going to take their religion, their form, and try to put it on you. So avoid people. Now, Timothy, he says, you're going to have very violent, stressful seasons in the last days. And we have been in the last days. And periodically, we will have these seasons. I think we are moving into a season of violence. I think we're going to be moving into a season of riots. And I hate it with all my heart in this United States of America and in Europe and in other civilized countries when people feel entitled, I deserve it, lovers of self, lovers of money, lovers of pleasures, but not lovers of God. We have to be lovers of God. You pick up the Bible and you look in it, and you look in it like you're looking in a mirror. If you see those things in you, it's time to get on your knees.